I look up and I see the door open and it's Paul and Linda. Now, it was quite surprising, and John's reading my lips because I'm going, Paul, Linda. And he's going, what? And he turned to his, turned and he sees them walking in. And Paul goes, hey. And John goes, yeah, hey, man. As if nothing had transpired.
That is the voice of May Pang, who from 1972 until about 74, 75 was John Lennon's girlfriend. Yes, a girlfriend. You know, if John were alive today, he'd probably quote Ross Geller and say he and Yoko were on a break. Welcome to Rock Conversations. I am your host, Rob Bob, otherwise known as Rob Hahn. And we are going to delve into so many great stories with May Pang. Her new film is out April 13th. It's called The Lost Weekend, A Love Story. And the film is excellent. I had a chance to screen it. The footage in it is absolutely fantastic. Both the video and the still photos give you a real, as a viewer, a front row seat. And that's exactly what May Pang had, not only to this love story, but to this great rock and roll story. And there might have been a little partying during the Lost Weekend, the year and a half or so they lived in L.A. She'll detail all of that in a matter of seconds. Remember, you can get Rock Conversations wherever you get your podcast, Apple, Spotify, and elsewhere. Be sure to tell a friend or two about us. And with that, let's get to our rock conversation with May Pang.
Oh, let's go back, let's go back, let's go back again.
We have the stereotype that I think it's fair to say that a lot of people chase rock stars. In this case, it was John kind of chasing you.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of strange. I know people have a hard time believing it, but I worked with them for 3 years prior to this whole, thing that's going on around me. So it wasn't like as if, oh, yeah, I'm chasing after him. Too busy to work. I'm like, I love my job. I loved it because I got a chance to do a lot of things. And I know it sounds funny and it sounds weird that when somebody says, but John Lennon came, I said, I don't care. That wasn't where I was going. I don't want that. It definitely took me to another level.
So take us through those early days. I think it was a Kiss at the studio, and then it was your decision and John's decision to take off to LA. I think that has been erroneously reported that
Absolutely.
It was Yoko's goal, but it was really yours.
Well, the Kiss, I will tell you, it was actually in the elevator when the door closed and I sort of freaked out. And then when we finally did get together, and it was after a couple of weeks, and he's chasing me. When we got together, it was finally towards the end of the album as well. We were working on Mind Games, and it was the perfect opportunity when he turned around. He said to his lawyer, who happened to be there at the time, saying, when are you going back to L.A.? Because he was based in L.A. And he said, oh, I'm leaving tonight. And he just turned and he said, well, guess what? May and I are going to jump on the plane with you. Now, he knew nothing. We didn't say a word. He didn't know that we were together. We were just, I'm there. I was working on something. And he just said, May and I are going to go with you. And that's what happened. We went to L.A. Nobody knew we were going. We just, on the spur of the moment.
What was John like when he was in L.A.? It sounds like he was very different, a different person than when he was in New York City.
He became, in a sense, a freer person. He got a chance to see a lot of his friends that he hadn't seen. Ringo, Tony King, who worked for Apple. We met Elton John. There was Mickey Dolenz out there. Saw Harry Nilsson. So there was a lot of friendships that he hadn't seen these people. So it was a rekindling of a lot of friendship. And we were also doing a lot of the press junket for him for Mind Games. We had just finished that album, and it was perfect that Tony King, who worked for John at for Apple Records, and he was on holiday, and we put him to work. So it was perfect.
You mentioned Elton John and Tony King. Tony kind of introduced you and John Lennon to Elton John, and boy, did that become a an incredible relationship, the three of you and the two of them as musicians.
Absolutely. It was a great time. We met Elton, and it was on my birthday when they were filming that the video, a promo for the Mind Games, where Tony King.
Yeah, that's a cool one. Yeah.
And I remember we got there to the studio afterwards, and we walked in, and I remember Tony's going, "It took me 3 hours, darling, to get into this outfit to look like this." And it was just very funny.
And that Madison Square Garden concert, a lot of people know the story. There was a bet, and if whatever gets you through the night goes to number one or hits the charts, then John had to agree to play live. It's one of my favorite Elton John concerts, not just because of John right. Lennon, because the Elton John portion is awesome. And for years, I think there were some legal issues with releasing the John performances, because those weren't on the original recordings that were sold to the public. But boy, take us to that night, Thanksgiving evening in Madison Square Garden, and history literally was made.
It was amazing. I was standing on the stage because John said, "Do me a favor, just stand so I could see you. So when I'm finished singing, I could see if it's a good night, because I could tell by if you're smiling or you're just looking at me." I said, "Okay." So I was really if you could find a photograph, I'm literally over Elton John's shoulder. I'm on the other side of behind him in the piano and off the side of the stage. And the bet came when we were picking out singles. And John was like, there were like four or five songs from the Walls and Bridges album, trying to figure out what's a good one. And finally, they chose, "Whatever Gets You Through the Night." And John's still hemming and hawing. He goes, "Maybe it should be this one. Maybe Going Down on Love. Maybe, so it was a whole raid." And he goes, no, "Whatever Gets You Through the Night." And he goes, "Well, okay." And he said, so Elton said, "Listen, I know it's going to be a big hit. And if it becomes number one, you'll have to get on stage with me and perform it." And so John said, "Okay, you are on." Now, John only took the bet because he didn't think it was going to become number one. So that being said, we know it went to number one, and it was John's only number one in his lifetime. It was only number one single. So with a number one album. So when the time came, Elton sort of hinted, and John said, he gave John an out. He said, "You don't have to really do it." He goes, no, a bet is a bet. And John actually enjoyed it, but enjoying it in the sense that when it was over, he enjoyed it. But at the moment leading up to it, he was miserable. He was so frightened. People, you talk about stage fright. He's throwing up. He's pacing. He's going through all these changes. He hadn't been on stage in a while, so it was kind of a little nerve-wracking for him. And we actually went up with Elton on his private plane to see what the look of the concert was. And someone actually mentioned, wrote to me recently saying, "I saw two people sitting, I live in Boston, saw two people in an area where there was nobody else except two people. Was that you?" I said, "Yes, we were sitting in the behind the scene and watching this whole thing." And you know how they block off seating areas now.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and that's where we were. Two lonely people back there watching this scene.
We're talking with May Pang. Her brand new movie is called The Lost Weekend, a love story, detailing a lot of her life spent with John Lennon in the early 1970s. Tickets can be found at thelostweekendtickets.com. I had a chance to screen the movie. It's fantastic. You mentioned Walls and Bridges and the studio, and I want to play a little audio here from Dennis Elsis, who was working for WNEW in New York City at the time.
Right. When the session was over, I was brought outside, and those were the days when John was with May Pang. And she was very lovely and chatty. And I said to May, being the ambitious young man that I was and figuring I got nothing to lose, if John would ever like to come up to the radio station, we'd love to have him, and certainly to promote the new album or whatever. And she said, "Okay, I'll look into it." So when the phone rings, you know, so many days or weeks later, and May says, yeah, John's up for it. When would you like him? How's Saturday at 4? And she goes, let me get back to you. And so that's how the interview happened.
So we have you to thank for what I think is an iconic radio interview.
You know, I knew Dennis back then first, you know, because doing press for John and Yoko, I met a lot of people ahead of time. So when Dennis asked, and I said, I just turned around, he goes, do you think I could get John for it? Now, we didn't have any, you know, we didn't have any press person in the middle of it. And I said, let me see. I said, I think we could work that one out. And I just turned around and I said, John, I think you need to do this. And he said, all right, go for it. So I booked it, and it was a Saturday afternoon, and I remember it being rainy. That I remember. So it was good, and I'm glad it worked out.
In a way, whether it was because of you or because he was with you or just because it was a different time in his life, John kind of came out of a shell of sorts and did a number of interviews from 72 until 74, maybe even beyond that, TV and radio.
Right. I think, you know, I forgot which record. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't, we were promoting Mind Games, but it was previous. And I remember Tony King sat down with also a couple of the promo people from Capitol and said, one of our favorite people, of course, who, that was there. He headed, all of a sudden his name escapes me, for God's sake, Al Corey. He was the guy. And they sat with John and said, listen, you haven't been as friendly as they would say, and you were very, he was in his militant way, you know, at that time was, you know, talking about give Ireland back to the Irish, and it was all this stuff going in a lot. It turned a lot of people off. We got to turn this around again. And the only way is you got to come back out and do some, you know, some promos and talk to these guys and talk to the program directors again and everything, because he had shut himself off, and he listened to them and he said, okay, I'm in. And once that happened, once that there was that freedom, it just changed his world.
Who coined the phrase the lost weekend, which was really what, almost a year and a half in LA?
Well, it was John. He wanted to, you know, he got tired. I mean, he said to me, he goes, I know it sounds terrible for us, you know, saying it about our relationship, but he goes, it's not about us, really. He got tired of all newscasters and journalists going, so what was it like when you were drunk and doing this? He goes, and then like using metaphors, and the metaphor, of course, at that time, and a lot of people don't know it, it was about the movie that Ray Milland did called The Lost Weekend, about a guy who was drunk, who kept, you know, doing the same thing. So that's why. But I guess a lot of the new generation would never know that that was a real movie before this.
There was a little bit of alcohol consumed during those days in LA, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, there was.
Talk about some of the characters involved. Yeah, let's start with Phil Spector. Alcohol, guns in the studio. I mean, this guy was a little off his rocker at times.
I think to say that is an understatement. It was difficult because John, you know, John could tolerate a little bit of drinking, but in our studio, when our studio life, when he would do sessions, you didn't find that in our sessions, because John would say, you're on the clock, you're working for me, well, let's do it. He goes, he would say, it's hard enough to think of something new, that you're going to play something new that isn't, and you're going to be drunk and or high. He goes, you could do it after, but not before. And so Phil Spector took us to a whole new level.
Were you happy? And was John happy with the rock and roll album in the end?
I would say partially. I mean, there was a percentage that he wasn't. He tried to make the best that he could out of some of the songs because he already paid for it. And,
sure.
And it was tough. And it was partly, it was a Phil Spector production. If you really listen to the rock and roll, when John finished his portion of producing it, it sounds quite different because it's a big lush sound for the Phil Spector wall of sound, as opposed to John, where it's quick. When you hear Stand By Me as opposed to... oh God, what was, I forgot some, Just Because on the other side of it. So there's two, you could hear the difference. So John was very keen on always making sure that the sounds are done correctly, you know, and get it done quick. He didn't like to dilly-dally. And with Phil, we had never experienced that, where the producer, the first day he comes in, and first off, we didn't know who was coming. We had 27 musicians. You had to see the engineer, and everybody was scrambling because we have a setup for 8, and now all of a sudden everybody's coming and go, Phil Spector session, and we finally see 27 musicians in the first night. And then, and of course, he arrived 3 hours late.
Sounds like a good start.
Yeah.
May Pang is our guest on Rock Conversations. Her brand new documentary is called The Lost Weekend, A Love Story. You can see more at maypang.com, as well as get tickets to see the film at a theater near you at thelostweekendtickets.com. The Beach House. I've heard stories about that. I learned more about it in your film. It hosted the two Kennedys and Marilyn Monroe at one point. So it's got that lore. Tell me more about the house and the characters who live there and those who came and went.
Well, I learned a lot. I mean, that house, I mean, the history behind it. I mean, John was fascinating. You know, you're talking about the Kennedys and you're talking about Marilyn Monroe. I mean, whoa, you know, Marilyn Monroe, what an icon, right? And also the house was owned by their brother-in-law at the time, Peter Lawford. So you can imagine all the stars. And then I found out that the house was built by Louis B. Mayer. You know,
no kidding. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I'm like, oh, yeah. So it's got its history, Hollywood history. And John was always into that. You know, there's all this Hollywood lore of, you know, of all the greats. So we were lucky to have it. So we had the main bedroom. I'll never forget when we came to see the place, and John, and I had no idea at the time, and him and Harry, because Harry, because it was for his album, they knew, and they were really renting it. So, and Harry thought it was a great idea. So you're having Harry Nilsson, you got Klaus Voormann in there. I had Keith Moon on one side of me, and we had Ringo on the other. That's just the start. Then, you know, during the day, we had everybody else that came in.
This sounds like the ultimate rock and roll frat house.
You're right. And that probably it would have been if it continued on even more. But it was good fun. John always thought, he goes, if I can get everybody in one area, then we can get them all to the studio on time. Because he's looking at the group. It's not like the mind game session where it's all the people, the session people, where you know they're going to be responsible, they're going to show up. This is like, okay, are we going to be able to get everybody there on time?
And of those names you mentioned, did they all play on Harry's album, Harry Nilsson's album?
Yes, that was the core group. So then, of course, Jim Kellner, who lives out there, so it didn't matter about him. And Mal Evans would come, you know, during the day, wherever he was staying, and he was our, you know, assistant on that too, you know, helping out whatever was needed. And Mal Evans, if nobody knows, was the original Beatles roadie.
What about the John and Paul McCartney dynamic during these years? There were meetings, you were part of them. The way it's portrayed, and I'll let you pick up on it, but the way I took it as a viewer is that they were old friends slowly getting over some differences of opinion.
Yeah, you know, they hadn't seen each other in several years at that point. And we were doing the Harry's album the first night, first session. Everybody, several of the musicians left, you know, the three drummers left. We had Ringo, Keltner, and Mooney. They finished their job, off they went. So, and whoever stayed behind, and we're just listening to playback, and John's listening, and all of a sudden I'm facing John, and I look up and I see the door open, and it's Paul and Linda. Now, it was quite surprising, and John's reading my lips, because I'm going, Paul, Linda, and he's going, what? And he turned to his, you know, and he turned and he sees them walking in, and Paul goes, hey, and John goes, yeah, hey, man, as if nothing had transpired from all that, you know, stuff before and the differences of opinion on their business side. They came and he goes, oh, what's going on? He goes, oh, is everybody finished? He goes, yeah, we're about to maybe do a jam. Would you want to stay? And everybody stayed. Of course, we didn't have a drummer. And the drummer, there goes Paul. He decided to go sit behind the Ringo. It turns out now we have several drum sets. He sat behind Ringo's. And during that jam session, of course, he broke his snare drum. So the next day, you know, Ringo came in and goes, who's been on my set? You know, who's been here? You know, he got really pissed off. But that session was just a lot of fun, just to blow off steam. It wasn't meant to be recorded to give out to people. It was more, you know, this was just, you know, after a hard day, night of working, as it were. And we were just sitting around, and I was just glad Mal and I got in. We played tambourine, and there's Linda on Hammond. And then, oh, yeah, we had a big surprise. We had Stevie Wonder, who happened to be in their studio, and he dropped by, and he's playing electric piano. And so we got a few people. We had somebody that played bass.
Few legends, yeah.
Yeah, you know, we had a few people.
In the few minutes we have left, I want to skip through a couple things very quickly. Monday Night Football, there was something unique, if not portending, that Howard would interview John at halftime of one game and then essentially deliver the news of John's passing to the country 5-6 years later. If I recall the story that night, Ronald Reagan was there as well. He was governor of California. And the story goes that, and you'll have to humor me with my Howard impersonation. He goes to Gifford. He says, you take the governor, I'll take the Beatle. Howard and John, you know, seem to have a certain rapport with one another. And maybe it was how he respected John's political stances.
Yeah, I mean, Howard was really great. I mean, you know, here's this guy that we only know for sports. John didn't know anything about the sports, obviously, but invited him to come on the show, and John said, okay. But what was really great that night, the best part was John came running over to me. He goes, you won't believe it. My favorite comedian's here. And it was Jonathan Winters. He was in the box as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
One of the most moving parts of the film, one of the most enjoyable parts, I think, is the way that you helped kind of nurture a relationship with John and his son, Julian. And Julian is featured in the movie in a great way. It's clear that the two of you have a good relationship. Take me through some of those early moments when you were navigating. You had Yoko in New York. You had John in L.A. You had Cynthia, John's ex, and Julian's mom visiting as well. I mean, and there you were, almost like the peacemaker.
You know what? I just ran on gut feeling and emotions, you know, and it's important. Family is important. I had a hard time because my father didn't care about me because I was a girl, you know, Chinese, you know, the way they look at things. So I was never a wanted child on that sense. But I see it with, you know, we're modern day. We're you know, here we are, a father and a mother, and they should not be apart. And they've been apart for 3 years. So I felt, and I needed to help mend that one. If I could do it, that was my gift to them without asking for anything. I just wanted to do it. And it was also gave a time for Cynthia and John to finally have closure that they never got when they split. And they talked it out, and it was much easier for me to deal with when they would be calling each other. And John used to have this angst. He goes, oh, you know, I've got to talk to Cynthia maybe. I don't want to. After this whole thing had cleared, after they settled everything, it was easy because all of a sudden he would get on the phone, he'd be speaking to Julian, or if Cynthia answered the phone, he said, oh, so how are you doing? There was now not none of that angst around and tension, and that made me happy, made everything easier.
When was the last time you spoke with John before his death? And what are your memories of that?
Oh, God. I remember it was the year 1980, but it was Memorial weekend. And, you know, it's a big holiday weekend. I went out with my girlfriends. We went shopping. I just come in the door and the phone started to ring and I'm going, oh, hello. Very, you know, one of my friends. Okay. And then I heard, hello, May. And I went, I just went cold. I knew. And I said, oh, John. And when I said, oh, John, one of my girlfriends whose husband is named John said, and she's pointing to herself, and I go, no. And I'm saying, no, 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 no. Waving her off. And she realized, and she said, and they all left me. All my friends left me because we were supposed to sit around and, you know, get gather and talk. But I was on the phone with him for about an hour and a half to 2 hours. And I said to him, my first line was, are you okay? And he just sort of goes, yeah. And I'm not convinced, but I'm not going to probe him any further than that. So then I said to him, where are you calling me from? He goes, Cape Town. And I just sort of said, are you kidding me? South Africa? You're out there? He goes, yeah. I said, what are you doing there? And he said, I'm just sort of, you know, Yoko sent me on that East meets West and whatever trip, and here I am. I said, okay. I said, then he would start asking me about all our friends and have I seen them? How's everything going? And he says, you know, he wanted to know, trying to find out when we could actually catch up with each other in person, and which never happened, obviously.
The film is The Lost Weekend, a love story. It is an incredible love story of May Pang, our guest, and John Lennon. There's so much we could still cover, but we're out of time. So I just want to thank you. It's been a great pleasure having this conversation, and I strongly encourage our listeners to take in the movie because they're going to learn so much more and enjoy so much more.
Thank you. Thank you so much.